Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Wonderful to have your company here. Today, we're having a really important conversation about leadership. Now, we all know that for the practice to grow, for the business to grow, first the leaders must grow. And we know that the growth of the business is correlated to the growth of the leadership team. So today, my guest, Mike Cameron, is sharing his thoughts, his insights, his experiences on the topic of leadership. But we're talking about leadership of a particular kind. We know that if we want our team members to show up committed, emotionally engaged, buying into what we're doing, we need to be able to connect with them at an emotional level. We need to have empathetic leadership. And Mike's specialty, his expertise, is on how to create that, how to lead from the heart, not just from the head, how to get that perfect blend of head and heart so you're effective and connected. We talk about a bunch of things on this podcast. And what Mike talks about is, you know, how to navigate through the messiness of day-to-day life. We know that life is not linear. We know that life is not structured as much as we would like it to be. And so how to take these principles and apply them to the complex and messy world that we live in. It's a really good conversation. It's an in-depth conversation. We talk about societal changes, expectations shifting, and how to cope and change with all of those things as well. And so, as always, have a pen and paper handy because there's a ton of value, a ton of wisdom that Mike shares. Now, Mike is also an author of a wonderful book called Becoming a Better Man, which is a really important book, I believe, for men to become the best leaders that they can be in a world that's changing, where expectations are shifting, where what was is no longer what's accepted. And so I think there's a really important lesson in there for men in particular. If you want to find out more about Mike's work, head across to mikecameron.ca and you'll find a bazillion different resources there that are rich, engaging, and really helpful. But for now, let's talk to Mike. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed it. Here he is. Mike Cameron, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us all the way from Canada. How are you today, man?
I am doing fantastic. It is so good to be here. I would actually rather be there, but hey, this is a close second.
It is a bit of a close second, but it is becoming increasingly common. I was listening to our politicians the other day talking about when they're going to open borders and when they're not going to open borders. I'm sure that conversation is happening in your country too, and everyone's trying to figure out how to kind of get back together in person. So hopefully we can do this live one day and we can get these two microphones in the same room and go from there.
That would be fantastic. For February of 2020, we were down in New Zealand for a trip. So my birthday is February 10th. And in recent years, we've been doing destination trips. I'm a long distance runner, so we usually find a race. We went down to New Zealand just before the lockdowns. Wow. And ran the Tarawera. So yeah, I would love to get back to Australia.
So how long is that run?
100 miler.
Oh, okay. So 160 kilometers or thereabouts.
Yep.
That's a long run. I can't let that go unremarked upon. Tell me about that run, 160 kilometers through New Zealand.
I only made it about 50 miles, so I ended up getting quite sick.
Only.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it funny? Hey, I actually was just talking about this morning. Like, at what point in my life did running 50 miles just become I only ran 50 miles.
That's phenomenal. New Zealand is, obviously, you've been there, of course, it's beautiful, it's picturesque. I would imagine in some ways similar looking to Canada in some respects, or no?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, definitely, you know, more tropical, definitely warmer. We were in, I think it's Rotorua. Yep. So where there's the steam, I don't even know what you call them.
The volcanic baths, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We kind of ran all through there and like it was just spectacular. It was absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, like I said, I ended up getting quite sick the day before. So wasn't sure how well I'd do. So I was actually thrilled. I made it 50 miles, things coming out places they shouldn't be coming out. And I just keeping the nutrition, keeping the food in. You're burning a lot of calories when you're moving that far. So if you can't replenish your calories, you're just going to end up really, really injuring yourself. So everything I'd eat, I'd throw up. And at some point, you've got to make the call and stop. So yeah, I made it about halfway and said, yeah, it's time to go.
Well, I will never say only 50 miles. I promise you that. I think 50 miles is an incredible achievement. And actually, this is not the introduction I thought I'd have with you, but I want, while we're here, let's go there. But I don't run long distances like that. That is phenomenal. I enjoy a recreational run. I've enjoyed that for years, but I've got a couple of friends who really get into ultra marathons and get into that super long distance running. And they all tell me about their own psychological well-being, their own, they get away mentally, they just kind of get into the zone. What does running those distances give you, do you think?
It's therapy. It's absolutely therapy. And, you know, for me, it's just that little push to do a little bit more each and every time. So it started with a 10K, ended up a half marathon, and then eventually a marathon. Then I got into triathlon. I did Ironman. And then I ran into some guys that were doing trail running, and trail running much more interesting than road running. And somebody talked about an ultra marathon, 30 miles, 50K. And I thought, okay, yeah, I could do that. So I did one of those. And then, you know, there was another event that was 50 miles. And then it was, well, you know, if you could do 50 miles, let's see what 100 feels like. So I've run 400-mile races and I've completed twice.
Wow, that's phenomenal. So what have you learned about yourself in going through that progression from 5 to 10 up to 100 miles?
You know, again, I think the big lesson is you can always do more than you think you can. There's always room for improvement. The other thing is that bite-sized pieces, one step at a time. And I use this analogy a lot in life. If I stand at that start line and I think about running 100 miles, there's absolutely no way, Jesse, I could run 100 miles. But if I think about, okay, well, that first aid station, the first checkpoint is 10 miles. Okay, well, I can run 10 miles. That's easy. I can run 10 miles all day long. So I just run my 10 miles. And then once you get to that first checkpoint, it's like, okay, you know, the next checkpoint is maybe another 10 miles. I can run 10 miles. And then eventually, you know, you get to 80, 90 miles. Well, now all of a sudden, it's not so much counting in 10-mile increments anymore. Now you're down to maybe it's steps. Like, I just need to take one more step. And one more step, and one more step. So it's about learning to narrow your focus as much as you need to be. And, you know, for me, I find the same holds true in life. When things get difficult, maybe you can't think about, oh my God, what am I going to do in a month from now? Or where am I going to be in a year from now? Well, when it gets difficult, just think about getting through the next day. Or if it's really difficult, the next hour or minute or second or 30 seconds or whatever it is. So it's just that kind of practice.
It's a really interesting thought process. And I love the concept of, you know, dealing with what's in front of you now. As you say, lining up at the start and trying to run 100 miles is quite discouraging. I'm thinking about that now. I'm breaking into a cold sweat just thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you that 80-mile mark, because I would imagine I've only run half marathons, so I'd be like a total amateur there. But in that 80-mile mark or 90-mile mark, you know, your body's aching, your body's probably starting to fail in some way. Where do you find those reserves to push through? And what is it that helps you kind of, it's one thing to narrow the focus, I get that, but how do you keep taking that next step?
I think it's just that commitment to the process. So it's not even so much about thinking of the outcome. It's, this is the process. This is what I've trained to do. I know I just need to continue moving forward. There's a book called Relentless Forward Progress. I think that's what it's called. But that's kind of the ultramarathoner's mantra is relentless forward progress. Doesn't matter if we're running a 5-minute kilometer pace or whether we're running a 25-minute kilometer pace. As long as we're moving forward, that's okay. And for me, when I've got to dig deep, I always flip that around to, okay, this is where we grow. Like, we don't grow in the first mile or 10 miles or 20 miles. I mean, maybe if that's your distance, then sure, maybe you do. But it's not the easy parts of the workout that we grow. Again, if you lift weights, you know, it's not those first 5 reps. It's the last 5 reps where you start to get to failure that actually start to build muscle. And again, same holds true in life. You can have a thriving business, a great practice. But if things were just always going good, that you're not growing, you're not learning.
Nah.
It's in those moments of challenge and difficulty that you can actually learn to grow. And that is where the growth comes. It really is about flipping that mindset. Quite frankly, that's why I run ultra marathons, so that I can practice in that controlled environment to embrace the suck rather than try and avoid the suck. Because as you're well aware, I'm sure life is going to throw some suck at you, whether you it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So in an ultra marathon, I get an opportunity to practice putting myself through those difficult circumstances in a controlled environment. There's always medical there. There's always, you know, somebody's going to rescue me if I fall over at the side of the trail.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just that practice.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about growth, because before we hit record, you were telling me that as a young man, you spent some time in Australia and you spent some time in Cairns on trawler boats. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, that was amazing. That's why I was saying Australia for me has a very large place in my heart. When I was 16 years old, I was a bit of an asshole, and you know, mom and dad didn't know what to do with me. I was getting into all the wrong things, drinking and smoking and doing drugs and just all the things I should not be doing. And mom and dad were kind of at their wit's end and didn't know what to do with me. So I remember coming home one day, and my mom's brother, John, lived in Australia, and they said, "How'd you like to go live with Uncle John for a little while?" And I thought, oh, hell yeah. Because my mom and John were missionaries' kids. They were born in Taiwan.
Oh, wow.
John was the rebel of his family. So probably when he was around a similar age, he ended up working in Taiwan. And as I actually just recently found out the whole story, he got into a car wreck and wrecked his boss's car and was going to get in a whole bunch of trouble in Taiwan.
Oops.
So he was out having a beer with the boys, so to speak, and ran into some guys that were sailors. And they said, "Well, why don't you jump ship with us and come to Australia?" So he went on as a stowaway on a boat from Taiwan to Australia, jumped ship in Australia, made a life for himself, built himself a multi-million dollar business from nothing.
Wow.
And flash forward, you know, now it's next generation. It was my opportunity to go work for Uncle John. And again, he was the black sheep rebel of the family, and he had done incredibly well. So he was a bit of a folk hero in my book. So when I had the opportunity to go work for him, because that was the idea, it wasn't you're going on a vacation to see Uncle John. It was, we're going to ship you over there and you're going to work your tail off and he's going to take care of you, but you're going to work. And that's exactly what happened.
So let's talk a little bit about that work, because working on fishing boats.
Yes.
That's not just sitting in an office pushing paper out. That's really physically demanding work, long hours, early mornings. It sounds romantic being out on the seas, but it is really hard work.
I did not spend a lot of time out in the boats. Most of what I did was the refits, so dry dock. So I was like down in the bilge pump, in the bilge with the rattle guns, chipping off rust and like coming up with half an inch of dust caked all over your... It was absolutely disgusting. But it was one of those things that I worked hard, and when I got home, he'd hand me a beer. I mean, I remember going to a quote unquote skipper's meeting at the local pub. I was 17 years old, and like nobody seemed to think it was strange that this kid was in the pub with them at this skipper's meeting. And these guys were pretty tough dudes. It was quite the experience.
So out of that, what did you learn? What did that time with Uncle John help you learn about yourself, learn about the world, learn about other people?
It's funny, because I think that's where I would give credit to my work ethic to what John did. Mm. We worked 10-hour days. We worked hard. It was not fun work, but we worked hard. We played hard, and he respected that. He rewarded that, and he took nothing less than everything you've got. Mm. And at the end of the day, that stuck. What ultimately ended up happening was I actually ended up getting into a car accident over there as well. And I was in a coma for 4 days, ruptured my spleen, crushed a lung, was in the hospital for 3 weeks. So I was maybe 30 minutes away from being dead. Australia is a very special place in my heart.
I have to ask, your mum and dad, when you went back home, What did they notice?
Yeah. So, well, it's interesting because I talk about that in my book. So mom came over when I was unconscious in the hospital. Mom ended up flying over. Mm. And I got to tell you, this 17-year-old, quote unquote, man, never been so happy to see his mommy in his entire life. Man, I tell you. So yeah, she came back and sort of nursed me to health. And she is, in fact, a nurse. But when I went back home, you know, not a lot changed. It's interesting when I reflect on that. I didn't get into trouble as such, but I think my attitude was much more, I'm invincible. You know, I've survived this. I'm invincible. I got a job and I tarred and I moved out and did my own thing and became my own man, so to speak. But there was definitely some value, but I'm not sure it was quite the turning point that they were hoping for.
Hey, well, it sounds like a fun adventure nonetheless. And as a young, late teenager type of adventure, I'm sure lots of fond memories there, which we probably can't share all of those on air, I imagine.
Yes.
But anyway, that's cool. So, Mike, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work in the leadership space, because that's obviously where you hang out and the work that you've been doing now for years and years and years. When it comes to thinking about leadership and business, and obviously there's people and, you know, you're trying to run an organization, it's not a nice, neat package. It's often messy. It's often fractured. It's often in a non-linear kind of process. And I wanted to just ask you a little bit about leadership in that kind of context, because most of the people that I work with, dentists, we're pretty structured, we're pretty orderly, we're either that way innately or over years of doing dentistry, we've become quite structured, methodical, like things just so. But our real world is not quite as nice as our structured world. And I wanted to talk a little bit about being effective in leadership in messy circumstances. Could we just kind of start there?
That's a great segue, because I think for me, there was a shift at some point where I would say I got out of my head and into my heart.
Yeah.
And that was a big shift. And I think that sort of speaks to what you're talking about. Intellectually, we think, well, this is the formula for leadership. This is the way it should be. And when it's not that way, sometimes we have a hard time responding. If we get so rigid and structured, so logical in our thinking, that we don't quite know what to do when things don't exactly go the way we want them to. It was very early in my career, actually shortly after I came home from Australia, I ended up getting a job again, didn't have a whole lot of skills, but I was a hard worker. I literally got a job bagging shit. I worked in a garden supply wholesale company bagging steer manure.
Yeah.
And again, being the hard worker that I was, you know, I knew I wasn't going to stay there. I worked hard. I eventually worked my way out of the soil plant where we were bagging dirt and manure into the warehouse. Eventually, I got my truck driver's license and I ended up driving the truck. Ultimately, I got into sales for this garden supply company. And what I realized at that point was that nobody buys a bag of steer manure because they want to own a bag of shit.
No. Nah.
They buy a bag of steer manure because they want that feeling that they will ultimately get when they plant that beautiful rose bush or grow that beautiful vegetable garden. So I started to recognize that my customers weren't buying the thing. They were buying the feeling they believed the thing would get them. And then eventually I kind of hit the ceiling where I was at and played hockey with a guy that was doing some finance stuff and having lots of fun, making lots of money. And so I said, hey, how do you do that? So he told me. I ended up moving into that industry and did quite well. Again, because I am sort of a head-centered guy. I'm a guy that likes to understand the why behind the what. So I started doing some research behind this. Okay, so if we buy on emotion justified by logic, what's the science behind that? There's a lot of science behind it. But I came across a fellow by the name of Antonio Damasio, and he wrote a book called Descartes' Error. And if you're familiar with René Descartes, the French philosopher, he's the one that posited, I think, therefore I am. Mm. Essentially, Damasio says, no, I feel, therefore I am. And he talks about emotion, reason, and the human brain. And so what he talks about, his science led him to the discovery that emotion is actually the edifice upon which reason is built. So not only do we buy based on emotion, but as human beings, we actually make decisions based, rooted on emotion. So I started to recognize that, okay, look, my customers, absolutely, if I can have a more emotional connection with them, I can sell more financial instruments. I can sell more garden supplies. And then as I moved into a leadership role, I started my own business in 2003. And as I moved more into a leadership role, I recognized same thing, that my team, my staff, my employees, they showed up much better when they were emotionally invested in what we were doing, not just intellectually invested, but they were emotionally invested. One of the best lessons I had in that from a sales context was I was 26 years old. I had been working in the finance space for about 2 years. I was doing really well financially. And I walked into the Porsche dealership in downtown Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And I remember Bill, the sales guy, he walked over, asked me a couple of questions just to make sure I at least some kind of prospect.
Yep.
And he walked me over to this yellow Porsche sitting on the showroom floor. He said, hop in. So he opens the door for me. I get in, closes the door, clunk, windows down. He reaches in and pushes the little button that slides back the convertible top. And he says, oh, you feel that? And he says, touch that leather. He goes, take a deep breath. He says, smell that smell. He says, doesn't that feel good? He says, now imagine driving this thing up the Sea to Sky Highway, which was about a 2-hour drive up the coast of British Columbia. It's just a gorgeous, windy drive. He says, just imagine driving this thing up the Sea to Sky Highway with the top down, the wind in your hair. This guy knew that we bought on emotion. So long story short, I ended up buying that Porsche. And I can tell you, there is nothing logical about buying a Porsche when you're 26 years old. It was all emotion.
Love that. It's really interesting that you share that story, because the concept of I think, therefore I am, and the I feel, therefore I am, the repositioning of that is really important in dentistry as well. And we say this to some of the guys we see all the time. People come and see us, and I've not yet had anyone walk into the practice and say, hey, doc, I'm so excited to be here for my filling, my root canal, my whatever it is, right? And it's a bit like you going back to the horse shit or the steer shit. No yes. one says, hey, you know, best bag of shit in town, right? No one says that, but it's the feeling. So I wanted to just come back to the bit around the leadership with the team, because you mentioned to me that the team show up really well when they're engaged in a process, or they're engaged in what they're doing, or they're engaged with the meaning behind the business. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about the emotional engagement of team and how to understand better how to perhaps foster that, but equally how to recognize it, how to nurture it, how not to kill it by mistake, basically.
Right. And I think that starts with self. So you can't recognize it in others if you can't recognize it in yourself. Yep. So I've got a bit of a formula or a framework that I use, that I teach. And it actually started in my men's work. So I do a lot of work with men and sort of emotional reconnection practice. And we can get to that. But I found it's especially applicable even in business. And that framework is the acronym SOAR, mm-hmm. S-O-A-R. And that's slow down. Just take a pause, take a breath, open up to whatever's coming up for you. You know, so often, and especially I would imagine with dentists, busy, 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 push it all down, push it all down. I don't got time to deal with that. Push it all down, push it all down. Just take that pause, slow down, open up to whatever's coming up for you right now, whatever the feeling is. And then the A is accept. And that's just, if we're frustrated, if we're angry, if we're feeling crappy, just accept that that's where we're at in the moment. So often for so many, there's this want to deny or feel like I shouldn't be feeling this way. So we judge the feeling rather than just accepting that that's where we're at. And then we start feeling shitty for feeling shitty, and it becomes this big spiral and down we go. And once we slow down, we open up, we accept, then we can reconnect with that emotional self. And in the context of leadership, again, it's the same thing. So it's maybe a reconnection with purpose. Why are we here? So let's slow down. Let's open up. Let's accept and let's reconnect with our purpose. Let's reconnect with who we are and who we want to be. And when we can start to do that with self, then we could start to do that with others as well and really start to get engagement. Again, as you said, I mean, do you have a purpose as a dentist, as somebody that runs a practice? What is your purpose as an organization?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. And if you ask a lot of dentists, I don't think that they're clear about that. And you'll often hear people say something, words to this effect, and forgive me for being a little trite as I say this, but oftentimes you'll hear someone say to provide the best possible healthcare in a state-of-the-art caring environment. And it's kind of, it's words that don't really
that doesn't make me feel anything.
Nothing.
Like, that's table stakes, man. If I'm coming in and writing you a check, I better be getting the best healthcare possible.
Exactly right. But and yet I've got other clients who'll say it's simply to help people smile again, or it's all those sorts of things. So again, I'm not getting to the depth of that. But the point.
I would go further and I would ask that question. Okay, so why do you want people to smile again?
The seven whys.
Why? Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm a big fan of the leadership challenge. I don't know if you're familiar with Kuz's and Posner's work. No. So they talk about the five exemplary practices of leadership: inspire a shared vision, model the way, encourage the heart, enable others to act, and challenge the process.
Mm.
It's called the leadership challenge. They've done a lot of work, a lot of research on that. But those five are just nice and easy to grab onto. So it's that inspire a shared vision. If you don't know what your purpose is as an organization, how can you possibly expect your team to get behind it if they don't know what it is? So it's that inspiring a shared vision. When I ran a mortgage brokerage company, we were trying to do something different within the industry. We were not just competing on price. We were not just competing on rate. We were talking about that customer experience. We want to demystify that customer experience, make it painless. Again, I'm sure a lot of the same things that you strive for as a dentist, as you said, for most of us.
You've just described our dental practice, actually.
Yeah. So for most of us, it's not a really exciting thing to have to go to the dentist. So I come back to process and that customer experience. What is that? What do you want that to be? And are you always looking at things through that customer experience lens? Mm. Just setting the expectations. We've got so much technology now. You schedule the appointment. I should be able to get a reminder. I should be able to get a couple of reminders. My dentist now sends me my COVID release form ahead of time just to make sure I check off the, have you had a fever in the last 24 hours? Mm-hmm. Have you done this? Have you done that? So the experience is consistent and it's positive. And they've got the front reception staff is fantastic. And I can tell you this because the beginning of this year, I probably had $10,000 worth of work done. I had a bunch of stuff that I had to deal with. So I appreciate that customer experience.
And as a dentist, I appreciate you valuing your healthcare enough to invest in it because I think it speaks volumes. One of the things that I just wanted to talk about there is the customer experience, because to get back to the I feel, therefore I am, you know, really what we're trying to invoke in our customer experience is for people to feel something.
Yes.
It's not just a case of completing the task. I've sent, you know, Mike, the COVID release form. It's not about being on task. It's about coming back to being on purpose, to your point earlier.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, again, we're looking at this from a customer service lens or patient experience lens, but same with the leadership and the team lens, is how do we create a circumstance with authenticity, add that in, so that we do invoke the feeling that we're trying to create in that other person, not from a ulterior motive point of view? I want you to feel like you love the yellow Porsche and you're going to feel the wind in your hair and I'm going to get a sale because of that. And I'm not at all trying to be rude about that experience. But if we want to create genuine connection, if we want to create engagement, we want to create all those things, how do we authentically create those feelings in a true way without the motive?
You hit the nail on the head when you talked about connection. Genuine human connection is what people are looking for. And so if we're talking about a leadership standpoint and how do we do that with our team, we care. And think about the employee that drops the ball and do you rip their head off, give them shit, and tell them to pick it up and don't ever do that again? Or do you sit them down and say, hey, Jesse, look, what's going on, man? Like, you're better than this. I know you're better than this. Is there something going on? And then just shut up, right? And that's the key piece, is that pause, practicing that pause. Because so often, even if we got to that point where I could say, hey, Jesse, what's going on, man? You're better than this. This isn't you. Usually I'm not going to wait for the answer. I'm going to go on and I'm going to rip you apart.
Yeah.
But if I can legitimately give you a little bit of space, and sometimes it's going to be that awkward silence, but silence is so powerful, because if I were to sit there for 60 seconds and just be quiet after saying that to you, chances are something's going to come up. If your employee is just incompetent, then obviously you have to address that. But I would suspect that 9 times out of 10, it's not a case of incompetence, because you probably wouldn't have hired them in the first place. So there's probably something going on. So just giving them the space to be able to share that. And again, whether they share or not, I had a rough night at home last night. My partner and I got into an argument or whatever, or my kids broke a expensive thing in the house this morning as I was leaving. So I would really frustrate it. Mm-hmm. So again, creating that empathetic space where it doesn't mean that you accept less than stellar performance. It just means that you create the space to understand why that's happening.
And to go back to your SOAR framework, really what you've just done, as we've been talking there, is you've slowed, very consciously, you slowed that conversation down. You've encouraged me to slow down. You've opened up, encouraged me to open up. And I'm assuming that when someone does open up to you, you accept it. You know, you accept the circumstances, maybe not the result. Okay, I understand that's happened. And how do we make this better? And then I guess you've reconnected and you move forward from there. So to use your framework, that sounds like what you've just taken me through there.
That's exactly it. And again, we can reconnect that to purpose. If our purpose is, and assuming that everybody buys in, because the reality is if they don't buy in, so if you've got a staff that's a problem and they don't buy into your purpose, well, they shouldn't be your staff anymore.
Of course.
I mean, it's as simple as that. So assuming they buy into the purpose, again, you can reconnect that to, okay, so I understand that you're frustrated that your kid broke your expensive vase this morning, but you showing up to work that way and operating in that manner, how do you think that connects with our purpose, when our purpose is to make sure that we create a customer experience, a patient experience that is second to none? Maybe. And again, this is where you can start to get creative and get curious. And curiosity, I think, is so underrated. For me, my mantra when it comes to curiosity is, anytime I'm finding myself in a position of judgment, I will very quickly flip that around to say, okay, well, hang on, Mike, where can you get more curious? So rather than judging a behavior, okay, where can I get more curious? And that's kind of what we've just walked through. Okay, so why is this happening for you? What's coming up for you? So again, just bring it all back around to assuming that we have inspired a shared vision. So we all agree that this is what we want as an organization. How do we do that? And then get creative. So if that's the case, maybe do you need to come in and to have a conversation and get that frustration out for 5 minutes before you start your shift? Or again, I don't know exactly what's feasible in your line of work, but is there an outlet for that? Or is it so bad that, you know what, maybe you need to take a day off?
Totally. I want to come back to a couple of little threads of the conversation that we had earlier about life not being linear.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, sometimes life is messy. Sometimes things don't go exactly as planned. And one of the things that I know as dentists is, because we run a schedule, we're seeing Mr. Jones at 8, we're seeing Mr. Smith at 8:30, and so on and so forth. I wanted to ask you about that first part of the framework, the slowing down, and the challenge around just making that conscious and how to do that deliberately with intention. The reason I bring it up is I know in the past, well, not even in the, let's say in the very recent past, I know that I've been guilty of, you know, going from one thing to the next, perhaps too quickly, not slowing down enough, and missing some of those cues. And so I wanted to ask whether you had any practices or thoughts or notions about just being deliberate about slowing down.
Yeah. So again, being intentional about what we're doing is critical. So just making the decision that this is something that's important in your life and will add value. And then it's just a matter of practicing that pause. So just learning to take that breath, starting to recognize when things are starting to go a little bit too quickly, or there's a potential for that, and just learning to stop and take that breath. The practice, the pause, is probably the biggest piece for me. And understanding that sometimes we have to go slower in order to go faster. Another lesson from running. When I first did my first Ironman triathlon, I had a coach that wanted me to go out at a very slow pace on a couple of my training runs. And I just had a hard time wrapping my head around, how is running this slow going to get me into a position where I can run the kind of race that I want? And in fact, there's all kinds of research that talks about how actually running slower for longer distances of time, you know, prevents injury. You can actually pick up speed. So the same holds true in life. I'm a bit of a climber, and that was one of the things my late partner taught me as a climber. She used to always yell at me when I was up on the wall. She'd yell, "Climb like a girl, climb like a girl." Meaning that as a guy, I was always clenched up. I was just going to muscle through everything. Whereas when you watched her climb, she was just graceful and she did it with ease. It looked like it was effortless. So when you can do things with ease rather than effort, it just becomes so much more fluid, so much more smooth, and you can in fact get more done faster with ease than with effort. In Canada, hockey is our national pastime, and we talk about gripping the stick too tight.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever heard that expression, but we talk about, he's gripping the stick too tight, just meaning that he's having an off game because he's working it too hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you just need to sit back and do it with ease.
I really love the concept of ease. And here's something I've noticed, and yeah, forgive me, gender stereotype about to pass my lips, but as a guy, and maybe this is true for women as well, I just don't have any experience to share around that. But I know typically for most of us, if things aren't working well, the natural instinct is to push harder, to work harder, to do more,
yes,
go faster, you know, more effort, basically.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing you say is if we're gripping the stick too tight, we have a similar concept in cricket as well. If you're holding the bat too tight,
yeah,
it's just you're going to get out. What I wanted to talk about is that, is that a common thing in men more than women, or is it across the board? Or I just notice in my own behavior sometimes that when I'm really trying to achieve something, it's often a case of I feel like I've got to push that little bit harder, try that bit more. I'm not afraid of hard work like most people, but there is a place where you've got to not give up, but kind of give in to something.
Surrender
is the word. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk to that for me?
You're exactly right. And definitely I do see that more in men than in women, without question, because again, we've got this sort of societal pressure that has built up for centuries, that we have to be the provider, that we have to be the guy, the man. And so there's this pressure. And as a result, we're wearing these weight vests that we have to run with, and we're working so much harder. Whereas, you know, if we could just shed some of that weight, we could actually move a lot easier with a lot more freedom, and it wouldn't be as challenging at all. So yeah, just again, not being of the mindset where we have to fix things. And so to come back to the leadership piece, this is really important, and I'm glad we got here. as leaders, we tend to believe that we have to have all the answers. Mm. I think maybe the model of leadership some 30 odd years ago was, well, you follow the guy that knows everything. Whereas I don't think that's the case anymore because A, we can't all know everything. Like, it's not that one individual knows everything, so that's why we follow them. And B, we've got Google. So we know most of those leaders from 30 years ago were probably full of crap.
Yeah.
So it's about understanding that as a leader, you don't have to fix everything. You don't have to have all the answers. In fact, I would suggest that having the right question is far more valuable than having the answer. People feel far more empowered when you ask them the question, and then you just employ that pause.
I heard someone say, Mike, that smart people have all the answers, brilliant people have the right questions.
Yes.
And I really think that there's something to that. I'm going to tread where angels fear to tread for a moment. That's probably the wrong segue, but I wanted to talk about leadership for men. We're going through a period of societal change. Cultural norms have shifted, have changed. The way we interact with people in the world of both genders has changed. And of course, the way we interact with our patients has changed. Things that we would have said, done, manners with which we would have behaved some years ago are no longer appropriate. So I wanted to talk about your book, Becoming a Better Man, because one of the things, I have two daughters, and I think sometimes it's very difficult for young kids growing up today in a world where there's lots of social upheaval to try and figure out their path. It's probably hard enough at the best of times when you're a teenager. But I do wonder about the role of men and how it's changing leadership for men and how to be more effective in that role and to kind of like that role as much as possible as well. Can we just have a bit of a talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I think it comes back to that, what I would call empathetic leadership and understanding the impact that emotions do have on human behavior. And I think the challenge many men have is that for, again, centuries, we have been taught to bury, suppress, ignore, and avoid feeling. Mm. Like, you know, if you ask most men, would you rather talk about your feelings or take a punch in the face? I bet you most of them would take the punch in the face, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
We're taught that there's two emotions, anger and sports. And so that does become a challenge when it comes to, again, back to Damasio's work. If we accept that we make decisions based on emotion, our decisions drive our behaviors. Our behaviors drive our results. If we don't understand the underlying feelings that drive those decisions we make, we have zero chance of living a fully awakened and purposeful existence. Mm. So again, coming back to that, just being able to slow down a little bit, practice that pause, open up to self and open up to others. That's sharing. And that's that vulnerability piece. You know, Brené Brown talks about that. Vulnerability is the core of all emotions. And that sort of, again, vulnerable leadership. I don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to have all the answers. You're an excellent dentist. That's why you do what you do. Doesn't mean you need to be an expert accountant. Doesn't mean you need to be great at customer service. Doesn't mean you need to be great at all these things. It means you need to hire people that are great at all these different areas and just accept and recognize your gaps.
You have touched on something that has been really important in my life, and that is vulnerability. And just full disclosure, big fan of Brené Brown and the work that she does as well. In fact, this is really interesting. You're probably familiar with the Theodore Roosevelt Man in the Arena speech.
Yeah.
She quotes that quite a lot. That's actually the culture for our coaching group, is the man in the arena. And to be in the arena, I think you've got to be vulnerable. I think you've got to be prepared to give it a go and fail, and to give it a go and to come up short, and to also, you know, give it a go and frankly get your ass handed to you from time to time, right? And I think that does require that openness, the ability to accept things, the ability to reconnect with yourself and with others and so on and so forth. So coming back to vulnerability and connection and empathetic leadership and really trying to understand what I suppose, male leadership looks like in today's world, it's changed. Kind of gone are the master and commander Russell Crowe days of standing on the, you know, on the bow of the ship, 3 miles, 3 degrees north, you know, whatever it is, you know, set course for whatever. That kind of leadership seems to have gone out by the wayside, which is probably quite good. So there's a neat answer to this, but can we just talk about some things for particularly men to consider in this? Because I do feel like it's a little harder for men to find their path when the role models and stereotypes are outdated and the world is changing quite quickly. A lot of men I speak to feel like they're deer in the headlights and not quite knowing whether to step left or step right. If I say this, I'm going to be called this, this, or this. And but at the same time, I don't quite know how to navigate this new world.
It's absolutely true. And so I think with that uncertainty comes sometimes there comes this want to push back, to regain control, regain power, because that's what we're supposed to do as men. Whereas I would suggest that the proper practice at that point is that surrender piece. Just surrender, get curious and understand. And understand that the game's changing, the rules are changing. We don't even know anymore what we're supposed to do. Are we supposed to hold the door open for a woman or are we not? I don't know. I mean, it's challenging for sure. And I'm not going to diminish that. And I'm not going to diminish the fact that it can be confusing and we're navigating some muddy waters right now. But I think, again, show up with that best heart, look inward. And again, start to feel more than think as you're navigating these things. Follow your heart rather than your head. It's just such a powerful piece when you can start to do that. But yeah, how do we do it? It's practice. So I think the answer is experimentation and practice.
I'm really glad you gave the how there, Mike, because I think a lot of people will be going, okay, well, that's great, Mike. Follow my heart, get out of my head. And as you say, experiment. And I guess this comes back to being okay with getting it wrong from time to time. If you're going to experiment, by definition, you're going to make a misstep or two. And
well, and it's so important because, again, even when we, like I said, I'm a bit of a science geek. I like to research. I like to understand things. But, you know, I was out for a run with a friend of mine one day and we were talking about nutrition and he's always up on these fad diets and all these things. And there's some new science that tells you X, Y, and Z. And this is why you shouldn't be eating 5 donuts after your run. Or this is why you should be eating 5 donuts after your run because carbs afterwards will load blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, Steve, that's all well and good. I said, but none of that research has been done on me. So the only way I'm going to know if that works for me or not is to try it. I mean, obviously, we can take some cues from science and research. Obviously, we don't have to go blindly everywhere.
Sure.
But the reality is we do have to find what works for us. And some of the stuff I'm preaching may not work for some individuals, and that's okay. But from my experience, a lot of this stuff works so well for so many.
I feel like I'm just about to open up a whole loop of conversation on this, Mike, if you'll indulge me for a second. Really interesting because what we're talking about is self-experimentation, finding out what works for you. And it's a really interesting thing that I wanted to just talk to for a second. This is perhaps a little bit tangential, but it's kind of been sitting in my mind. One of the things that drives me a little bit potty in life is when we look for the 7 quick steps or the 5 hacks to this, or you know, everything's binary, it's black or white, good, bad. My world is a much more nuanced world. And it's really interesting to the point where you said with the SOAR framework around slowing down, I feel like in today's world, we're so busy, we're so hurried, that we're kind of looking for formulas, recipes, blueprints, and life's not a blueprint. Life's not a 10-step plan or a paint-by-numbers exercise. You know, you've got to get outside the lines a little bit and make a mess and stuff it up and learn some stuff. So I really liked what you're talking about there was that science is great, but no experiments have been done on me and I've got to find our own path. So I wanted to just talk about navigating and finding your own path in a world that's busy, messy, with so much information coming towards us, such a rate of knots. How do we take all of that incoming stimuli and kind of synthesize that into our own experiments and our own code of doing things, rather than following someone else's seven easy steps that may or may not work for us?
Right. Well, again, I think that does come back to the slow down piece.
Yeah.
That's the first one. As you said, there's just a whirlwind of data and information that's being thrown at us, and we don't have to accept all of that. So just slow it down. Take that pause. Find that one thing that you want to work on. Again, I come back to who you want to be rather than what you want to achieve. And that can hold true with organizations as well. Who do you want to be as an organization versus what do you want to achieve? I wrote a piece, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago, that's something around the, because again, clickbaity, 6 reasons why I stopped setting goals, or 4 reasons why goal setting is bad for you. And I, in fact, stopped setting goals about a decade ago. And instead, I shift to a different framework. Instead of setting goals, I set values, I set intentions, and I set milestones. And, you know, milestones are much more akin to your traditional goals. They're the third down the line. So my values, again, curiosity, empathy, integrity, honesty, compassion, those are the core values. That's my true north. And even to the point of where I've actually had to let a vendor go, because it was very clear that our values were not aligned. Some of the practices they were doing, I just looked at it, I said, you know what? I was trying to decide, because it's going to be a pain in the ass for me to switch vendors. And I was talking about this with my partner, and I was telling the story, and it just struck me as I was telling her what was going on. I just thought, man, that does not align with my values at all. How can I have these conversations and share this information with you if I don't even live that? And so it was instantly easy decision, right? So when those values are clear, they become the things that we make our decisions on. And then intentions are, how do we want to show up? And that's, for me this year, one of my intentions is to be bold, get a little more out there. But if we've got our values and our intentions as that North Star, that thing that's pulling us, those milestones just become offshoots along the way. So when I was in my early 20s, my big goal was to make $100,000 a year. That was the big goal. But if you think about it, did I really want to make $100,000 a year? Well, no, because that doesn't really do anything. What I wanted was the status, the prestige, the perceived freedom that would come with that. As I progressed in my business and I had a family, then it was like, I want to have $1 million in the bank account. Well, why do I want that? You don't really want $1 million in the bank account. You want the freedom so that I can do all the things with my family. We can go on nice vacations. We can do all the things. And as a result, when I focused on the goal of having that money in the bank, I'd end up making decisions that actually took me further away from my family, right? And well, as a dentist, I'm sure totally. You guys can, you can be as busy as you want, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's the classic thing. There's a great saying that making money is killing your business. And it sounds ironic, of course, but the whole idea is people go into business because they want to provide a lifestyle for their family, or want, they want to provide security for their family. And yet the things that they hold dearest are the things they give up in order to provide that so-called benefit, the money in the bank and so on. So it's really interesting. But I think one of the things that I've really appreciated about our conversation, or lots of things we've appreciated about our conversation, but something that really has resonated with me is really the importance of slowing down. And I think that's such power in just breathing, pausing, stopping, reflecting, challenging the status quo. Do I really have to do this? This way? Is there another way? What else could I do? And to really be, as you say, curious and intentional, and all of the things that come up in that space, because life, as I said, I believe at least, is not one size fits all paint by numbers exercise. And so if we're going to create this rich and purposeful life, I think we want to do that by intent or by design rather than by default. And I think when people are so busy, you kind of get caught up with what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Like, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. When we started our conversation before we hit record, I said to Mike, ladies and gents, look, I just like a good conversation. And Mike, you have been an excellent conversationalist. You've been generous with your insights. You've been generous with your experience. So thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking to you so much indeed.
My pleasure. It's been my pleasure. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah. Ladies and gents, I'm going to put the links to Mike's website up in the show notes, but please head across to mikecameron.ca and check out his books, check out the video there, check out the blog. And if you're looking for resources or coaching or anything of that nature, I'd really suggest you check it out, because as you can see from what we've spoken about today, there's a depth of understanding and there's heart behind the head. And when you've got that wonderful combination of heart and head, you can't help but go far in life. So again, Mike, thank you so much for everything today. It's been an absolute thrill to talk to you.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.